their victim has been the completely blameless Mr. Tweed. But these killers are cold and cunning. They concoct a story that suggests that Mr. Morriston was attempting blackmail, and 2 days later, they poison him with hemlock stolen from the same laboratory that provided the scalpel. It is clever, is it not? The finger of blame points at the biology teacher, Miss Colne, and this time, their true motive is completely concealed. Extract from Death Treads the Boards by Donald Lee. Chapter 21. The Final Act. It was very dark in the theatre. The light of the day was fading quickly outside, and the ominous sky was full of heavy, ugly clouds. In just 6 hours' time, 1920 would come to an end, and 1921 would begin. But Detective Superintendent McKinnon was already celebrating the new year inside his head. He had worked it all out. He knew who had committed the murder, and soon he would confront that person, pinning him to the floor with the ruthlessness of a scientist with a rare butterfly. Sergeant Brown looked carefully at the suspects, asking himself for the 1,000th time which one of them could have stabbed the history teacher, Ewan Jones, in the throat on that unforgettable night. Which one of them? They were sitting in the half-abandoned theatre, not looking comfortable, each one of them doing their best to avoid the other's eyes. Henry Baker, the director of the play, was stroking his moustache, as he always did when he was nervous. The writer, Charles Hawkins, was smoking a cigarette, which he was holding in those stubby fingers that were always stained with ink. Was it just a coincidence that he had been badly wounded at Ypres at the same time as the second victim, the theatre manager, Alistair Short, who had been mysteriously poisoned with arsenic a few days later? Could there be a connection? Short had £200 stashed away in his bedside cupboard, and it looked very much as if blackmail could have been the name of his game. Where else could he have got the money? It was a shame that he hadn't lived to tell the tale. Which one of them? Brown still suspected Lila Blair. His thoughts hurtled back to the moment when she had thrown herself at Short, screaming at him and accusing him of destroying her career. "I hate you," she had screamed. "I wish you were dead." And 70 minutes later, he had indeed been dead, just as she had wanted. And what about Ian Lithgow, the young, handsome, smiling actor who had been too young to fight at Ypres? There could be no connection there. But he had gambling debts, and people who need money desperately will often do desperate things. Brown waited for his boss to collect his thoughts. And now, the moment he had been waiting for arrived. As McKinnon got to his feet, there was a brief roll of thunder in the heavy, oppressive air. The new year was going to start with a bad storm. Everyone stopped what they were doing and looked up as he adjusted his monocle, and then began to speak. "On the night of the 20th of December," he began, "a murder was committed here, in the Roxbury Theatre, during a performance of Aladdin. But it was the wrong murder. Alistair Short was the real target, but the killer got it wrong, because at the last moment, Mr. Short and Mr. Jones had swapped seats." McKinnon paused for a moment, examining each one of the suspects as they drank in his words. "But who was the killer who ran off the stage and plunged the knife into Jones's throat?" he continued. "There were two people who it couldn't have been. Charles Hawkins couldn't have run through the theatre. He only had one leg. And as for Nigel Smith, he was on stage at the time in full view of the audience. It couldn't be him either. At least, that's what I thought." There can be no doubt that Alan stole Donald Lee's idea. He changed the time period from the 20s to the late 40s, and the setting from an end-of-the-pier theatre to a preparatory school, which he based on Chorley Hall, renaming it Forley Park. Elliot Tweed is a thinly disguised portrait of his father, Elias Conway. Oh yes, and all the teachers are named after British rivers. The name of the detective, Inspector Ridgway, may have been borrowed from Agatha Christie's Death on the Nile, another river. But the mechanism is the same, and so is the motive. An officer abandons his men at a time of war, and years later, the only survivor joins forces with the son of one of the men who died. They swap places during the performance of a play, committing the murder in full view of the audience. Detective Superintendent Locke would have found it a tad unlikely, but in the world of whodunit fiction, it worked just fine. After I read the two books, I rang the Arvin Foundation, which I correctly guessed had hosted the course that Donald had attended. They were able to confirm that Donald Lee had indeed been at their manor house at Totley Barton, Devon. It's a lovely place, by the way. I've been there myself. I would have said that the chances of a visiting tutor stealing the work of one of his students was about 1,000,000 to 1. But looking at the two versions, that's what had happened. I felt sorry for Donald. Frankly, he can't write. His sentences are leaden, lacking any rhythm. He uses too many adjectives, and his dialogue is unconvincing. Alan was right on both counts. But he didn't deserve to be treated this way. Could he have done anything about it? He told me he had written to Charles and had received no reply. That wasn't surprising. Publishers get cranked letters all the time, and this one wouldn't have got past Jemima. She'd simply have binned it. The police wouldn't have been interested. It would have been easy enough for Alan to claim that he had given the idea to Donald, rather than the other way round. What else could he have done? Well, he could have found Alan's address in the records of the Ivy Club, travelled up to Framlingham, pushed him off the roof, and ripped up the final chapters of his new novel. I'd have been tempted to do the same in his place. I'd managed to spend most of the morning reading, and I was meant to be having lunch with Lucy, our rights manager. I wanted to talk to her about James Taylor and the Atticus adventures. It was 12:30, and I thought I'd slip out for a quick cigarette on the pavement outside the front door. But then I remembered the letter at the top of the pile, the one that had spelled my name wrong. I opened it. There was a photograph inside. No note, no name of any sender. I snatched the envelope back and looked at the postmark. It had been sent from Ipswich. The photograph was a little blurry. I guessed it had been taken with a mobile phone, enlarged and printed at one of those snappy snap shops you find everywhere. You can plug directly into their machines, so, assuming they paid cash, the person who had taken the photograph would have been completely anonymous. It showed John White murdering Alan Conway. The two men were at the top of the tower. Alan had his back to the edge, and he was bent over towards it. He was dressed in the same clothes, the loose jacket and black shirt, that he had been wearing when he was found. White had his hands on Alan's shoulders. One push, and it would all be over. So that was it. The mystery was solved. I rang Lucy and cancelled lunch. Then I began to think. Detective work. It's one thing reading about detectives, quite another trying to be one. I've always loved whodunits. I've not just edited them. I've read them for pleasure throughout my life, gorging on them, actually. You must know that feeling when it's raining outside and the heating's on and you lose yourself utterly in a book. You read and you read and you feel the pages slipping through your fingers until suddenly there are fewer in your right hand than there are in your left. And you want to slow down, but you still hurtle on towards a conclusion you can hardly bear to discover. That is the particular power of the whodunit, which has, I think, a special place within the general panoply of literary fiction. Because of all characters, the detective enjoys a particular, indeed, a unique relationship with the reader. Whodunits are all about truth, nothing more, nothing less. In a world full of uncertainties, is it not inherently satisfying to come to the last page with every I dotted and every T crossed? The stories mimic our experience in the world. We are surrounded by tensions and ambiguities, which we spend half our life trying to resolve. And we'll probably be on our own deathbed when we reach that moment when everything makes sense. Just about every whodunit provides that pleasure. It's the reason for their existence. It's why Magpie Murders was so bloody irritating. In just about every other book I can think of, we're chasing on the heels of our heroes, the spies, the soldiers, the romantics, the adventurers. But we stand shoulder to shoulder with the detective. From the very start, we have the same aim, and it's actually a simple one. We want to know what really happened, and neither of us are in it for the money. Read the Sherlock Holmes short stories. He's hardly ever paid, and although he's clearly well off, I'm not sure he once presents a bill for his services. Of course, the detectives are cleverer than us. We expect them to be. But that doesn't mean they're paragons of virtue. Holmes is depressed, Poirot is vain, Miss Marple is brusque and eccentric. They don't have to be attractive. Look at Nero Wolfe, who was so fat that he couldn't even leave his New York home and had to have a custom-made chair to support his weight. Or Father Brown, who had a face as round and dull as a Norfolk dumpling, eyes as empty as the North Sea. Lord Peter Wimsey, ex-Eton, ex-Oxford, is thin and seemingly weedy and sports a monocle. Bulldog Drummond might have been able to kill a man with his bare hands and may have been the inspiration for James Bond, but he was no male model either. In fact, H.C. McNeil hits the nail on the head when he writes that Drummond had the fortunate possession of that cheerful type of ugliness which inspires immediate confidence in its owner. We don't need to like or admire our detectives. We stick with them because we have confidence in them. All of this makes me a poor choice of narrator-investigator. Quite apart from the fact that I'm completely unqualified, I may not actually be all that good. I have tried to describe everyone I saw, everything I heard, and most importantly, everything I thought. Sadly, I have no Watson, no Hastings, no Troy, no Bunter, no Lewis. So, I have no choice but to put everything onto the page, including the fact that, until I opened the letter and saw the photograph of John White, I was getting absolutely nowhere. In fact, in my darker moments, I was beginning to ask myself if there really had been a murder at all. Part of the trouble was that there was no pattern, no shape to the mystery I was trying to solve. If Alan Conway had lent his hand to the description of his own death, as he had with Sir Magnus Pye, I'm sure he'd have given me a variety of clues, signs, and indications to lead me on my way. For example, in Magpie Murders, there's the handprint in the earth, the dog's collar in the bedroom, the scrap of paper found in the fireplace, the service revolver in the desk, the typed letter in the handwritten envelope. I might not have any idea what they add up to, but at least as the reader, I know that they must have some significance, or why else would they have been mentioned? As the detective, I had to find these things for myself, and perhaps I'd been looking in the wrong direction, because I seemed to have precious little to work with. No torn buttons, no mysterious fingerprints, no conveniently overheard conversations. Well, of course, I had Alan's handwritten suicide letter, which had been sent to Charles in a typed envelope, the exact reverse of what I had read in the book. But what did that mean? Had he run out of ink? Had he written the letter, but asked someone else to write the address? If you read a Sherlock Holmes story, you can be pretty sure that the detective will know exactly what's going on, even if he won't necessarily tell you. In this case, that's not true at all. There was also that dinner at the Ivy. I still couldn't get it out of my mind. Alan had become annoyed when Charles had suggested changing the title of his book. Matthew Pritchard, sitting at the next table, had heard what he had said. He had pounded the table, then jabbed with a finger, "I'm not having the..."
The what?
"I'm not having the title changed. I'm not having the discussion. I'm not having the dessert, thanks." Even Charles wasn't sure what he had meant. I might as well come straight out with it. I didn't think John White killed Alan Conway, even though I had photographic evidence of him committing that very act. It was like the suicide letter that wasn't actually a suicide letter. Except that this time, I didn't even have the beginning of an explanation. I simply didn't believe it. I had met White, and I didn't see him as being a particularly violent or aggressive person. And anyway, he had no reason to kill Alan. If anything, it was the other way around. There were other questions, too. Who had sent me the photograph? Why had they sent it to me rather than the police? It must have been posted on the same day as the funeral, and the postmark showed Ipswich. How many people at the funeral knew that I worked at Cloverleaf Books? My name was misspelled on the envelope. Was that a genuine error, or a deliberate attempt to make it appear that they didn't know me well? Sitting on my own in the office, just about everyone else had gone out to lunch, I drew up a list of suspects. I could think of 5 people who were far more likely than White to have committed the murder, and I set them out in order of likelihood. It was quite confusing. I'd already performed exactly the same exercise when I'd finished Alan's book. Number 1. James Taylor, the boyfriend. As much as I liked James, he was the one who most directly benefited from Alan's death. In fact, if Alan had lived another 24 hours, he would have lost several million pounds. He knew Alan was in the house. He would have guessed that Alan would have gone to breakfast on the tower, because the weather was so good on that penultimate day in August. He was still living there, and could have let himself in, crept upstairs, and pushed him off in the blink of an eye. He told me he was in London over the weekend, but I only had his word for that, and he had seemed completely at home when I met him, as if he knew that Abbey Grange was his. Of course, it's the first rule of whodunits that you discard the most obvious suspect. Was that what I should do here? Number 2, Claire Jenkins, the sister. In all those pages she gave me, she went on about how much she adored her brother, how generous he was to her, and how close they had always been. I wasn't sure I quite believed her. James thought she was jealous of his success, and it's certainly true that in the end, the two of them argued about money. That wasn't necessarily a motive for murder, but there was another very good reason to put her second on my list, and it related to the unfinished book. Alan Conway took a spiteful pleasure in creating characters based on people he knew. James Taylor turned up as the slightly dim, foppish James Fraser. The vicar appeared as an anagram of himself. Even Alan's own son was there by name. I had no doubt at all that Clarissa Pye, Sir Magnus's lonely spinster sister, was based on Claire. It was a grotesque portrait, which Alan made more pointed by describing her house, and even naming Daphne Road, although in the book it's Brent who lives there. If Claire had seen the manuscript, she might have a very good reason to push her brother off the roof. It would also have been in her interest to ensure that the book was never published, something she would have achieved by stealing the last chapters. Why, then, would she insist that Alan had been murdered? Why draw attention to what she had done? I have no real answer to that, but thinking it through, I remembered reading somewhere that killers have an urge to claim ownership. That's why they return to the scene of their crime. Could it be that Claire had asked me to investigate her brother's death for the very same reason that she wrote that long account? A pathological desire to be center stage. Number 3. Tom Robeson, the vicar. It was a pity that Robeson wouldn't tell me exactly what had happened at Chorley Hall when I confronted him at the church. If his wife had arrived a few minutes later, it would have made all the difference. But the incident had involved a photograph used to humiliate a boy in an all-boys school, and I didn't need to work too hard to get the general idea. It was interesting, incidentally, that Claire saw her brother as one of the victims of the school's various cruelties, while Robeson saw him as more of an active participant. The more I learned about Alan, the more I was inclined to believe the vicar's account. All this had taken place back in the 70s, and it had clearly been on Alan's mind, because he had written about it in the first chapter of Magpie Murders, when Mary Blakiston turns up in the vicarage. And there they were, just lying in the middle of all his papers. What had she seen? Were Henrietta and Robin Osborne perverts of some sort? Had they left out incriminating photographs, similar in nature to the ones that had tormented Robeson? From what he had said in his funeral address, The vicar hadn't forgotten any of this, and having met him, I could quite easily see him creeping up to the top of the tower to get his revenge. That said, it's always been my belief that vicars make poor characters in crime novels. They're somehow too obvious, too Little England. If Robeson did turn out to be the killer, I think I'd be disappointed. Number 4. Donald Lee, the waiter. "You must have been quite pleased to hear he was dead," I had said. "I was delighted," he replied. "Two men don't see each other for several years. One hates the other. They meet quite by chance, and 48 hours later, one of them is dead." When I put it in black and white like that, Donald had to be on my list, and it would have been a simple matter for him to get Alan's address from the club records. What else is there to say? Number 5. Mark Redmond, the producer. He lied to me. He said that he went back to London on the Saturday, when the register showed that he'd actually stayed the entire weekend at the Crown. He also had every reason to want Alan dead. But Attica's adventures would have been worth a fortune if he could get them off the ground, and Redmond had invested a lot of his own money seeding the project. He certainly knew a thing or two about murder, having masterminded hundreds of them on British TV. Would it really have been so difficult to move from fiction to reality? After all, the murder had been a bloodless one. No guns, no knives, just a simple push. Anyone could do that. Those were the 5 names on my list. The 5 little pigs, if you like, that I suspected of committing the crime. But there were 2 other names, which I didn't add, but which should perhaps have been there. Number 6, Melissa Conway, the ex-wife. I hadn't had a chance to speak to her yet, but decided I would travel down to Bradford-on-Avon as soon as I could. I was beginning to obsess about Alan's murder, and I wasn't going to get any work done at Cloverleaf until it was solved. According to Claire Jenkins, Melissa had never forgiven Alan for the way he had left her. Had they met recently? Could something have happened that might have prompted her to take revenge? I was annoyed that I'd missed her at the hotel. I would have liked to have asked her why she travelled all the way up to Framlingham to attend her husband's funeral. Had she made the same journey to push him off the tower? Number 7. Frederick Conway, the son. It may not be fair to include him. I had only glimpsed him at the funeral and knew almost nothing about him. But I still remembered how he had looked that day, staring at the grave, his face positively distorted by anger. He had been abandoned by his father. Worse than that, his father had come out as a gay man, and as a schoolboy, that might not have been easy for him either. A motive for murder? Alan must have been thinking about him when he wrote Magpie Murders. Freddy turns up as the son of Sir Magnus and Lady Pye, the only character who retains his true name. These were the notes that I made, sitting in my office that Monday afternoon. And by the time I left, I had got precisely nowhere. It's all very well having suspects. When push comes to shove, as indeed it had, all 7 of them, 8, counting John White, could have killed Alan Conway. For that matter, it could have been the postman, the milkman, someone I'd forgotten to mention or someone I hadn't met. What I didn't have was the interconnectivity you get in a murder mystery, the sense that all characters are moving in tandem, like pieces on a Cluedo board. Any one of them could have knocked on the door of Abbey Grange on that Sunday morning. Any one of them could have done it. In the end, I shoved my notepad aside and went for a meeting with one of our copy editors. If I had just worked a little harder, I would have realized that the clue I had been seeking was actually there. That somebody had said something to me quite recently that had identified them as the killer, and that the motive for Alan's murder had been in front of my eyes the moment I had begun reading Magpie Murders. Just 30 minutes more might have made all the difference in the world. But I was late for my meeting, and I was still thinking about Andreas. It was going to cost me dear. Bradford-on-Avon. Bradford-on-Avon, was the last stopping point of my journey into the fictitious world of Magpie Murders. Although Alan had used Orford as a model for Saxby on Avon, the very name shows where his thoughts lay. What he had done, in effect, was to synthesize the two. The church, the square, the two pubs, the castle, the meadowland, and the general layout belonged to Orford. But it was Bradford on Avon, which lay a few miles outside Bath, and which was filled with the solid Georgian constructions made of Bath stone with handsome porticos and gardens rising up in terraces that the book describes. I don't think it was a coincidence, but it happened to be the place where his ex-wife lived. Something had happened that had made him think of her. Somewhere inside Magpie Murders, there was a message intended for her. I telephoned ahead and travelled down on Tuesday morning, taking the train from Paddington Station and changing at Bath. I would have driven, but I had the manuscript with me and planned to work on the way. Melissa had been pleased to hear from me and had invited me to lunch. I arrived just after 12. She had given me an address, middle rank, that led me to a row of terraced houses high above the town, unreachable except on foot. It was in the middle of an extraordinary warren of walkways, staircases, and gardens, which could have been Spanish or Italian in origin if they hadn't been so determinedly English. The houses stretched out in three rows, with perfectly proportioned Georgian windows, porticos above many of the front doors, and yes, that honey-coloured Bath stone. Melissa had three floors and a busy garden that picked its way in steps down the hill to a stone pavilion below. This was where she had moved after Orford, and although I hadn't seen where she had lived when she was there, it struck me that this must be the antithesis. It was peculiar. It was secluded. It was somewhere you would come if you wanted to escape. I rang the doorbell, and Melissa answered it herself. My first impression was that she was much younger than I remembered her, although we must have been both about the same age. I had barely recognized her at the funeral. In her coat and scarf, with the rain falling, she had blurred into the crowd. Now that she was standing in front of me, in her own home, she struck me as confident, attractive, relaxed. She was slim, with high cheekbones and an easy smile. I was sure her hair had been brown when she was married to Alan. Now it was a dark chestnut and cut short down to the neck. She was wearing jeans and a cashmere jersey, a white gold chain, and no makeup. It's often occurred to me that divorce suits some women. I'd have said that about her. She greeted me formally and led me upstairs to the main living room, which ran the whole length of the house, with lovely views over Bradford-on-Avon and onto the Mendip Hills. The furniture was modern traditional and looked expensive. She'd laid out lunch, smoked salmon, salad, artisan bread. She offered me wine, but I stuck to sparkling water. "I saw you at the funeral," she said as she sat down. "I'm sorry I didn't speak to you, but Freddy was in a hurry to be away. I'm afraid he's not here. He's got an open day in London." "Oh, yes." "He's applying to St. Martin's School of Art. He wants to do a course in ceramics," she went on quickly. "He didn't really want to be there, you know, in Framlingham." "I was quite surprised to see you." "He was my husband, Susan, and Freddy's father. I knew I had to go as soon as I heard he was dead, and I thought it would be good for Freddy. He was quite badly hurt by what happened. More than me, I'd say. I thought it might give him some sort of closure."
"Did it?"
"Not really. He complained all the way there, and he said nothing on the way back. He was plugged into his iPad. Still, I'm glad we went. It felt like the right thing to do."
"Melissa," this was the difficult bit, "I wanted to ask you about you and Alan. There are some things I'm struggling to understand."
"I did wonder why you'd come all this way." On the telephone, I told her that I was searching for the missing chapters, and that I was trying to work out why Alan had killed himself. She hadn't needed any more explanation than that, and I certainly wasn't going to mention the fact that he might have been murdered. "I don't want to embarrass you," I said.
"You can ask me anything you want, Susan." She smiled. "We'd been apart for 6 years when he died, and I didn't feel embarrassed about what happened. Why should I? Of course, it was very difficult at the time. I really loved Alan, and I didn't want to lose him. But it's odd. Are you married?
No.
When your husband leaves you for another man, it sort of helps. I think I'd have been angrier if it had been a younger woman. When he told me about James, I saw it was his problem, if it was a problem. I couldn't blame myself if that was the way he felt. Did you have any inkling of it while you were married? If you're talking about his sexuality, no, not at all. Freddie was born 2 years after we were married. I'd say we had a normal relationship.
You said it was harder for your son.
It was. Freddie was 13 when Alan came out. And the worst thing was that the newspapers got hold of the story and the children read about it at school. Of course he was teased, having a gay dad. I think it would be easier if it happened now. Things have moved on so fast. She was completely without rancor. I was surprised and made a mental note to cross her off the list I had drawn up the day before. She explained that the divorce had been amicable, that Alan had given her everything she wanted, and had continued to support Freddie, even though there had been no contact between the two of them. There was a trust fund to take him through university and beyond, and, as James Taylor had mentioned, he had been left money in the will. She herself had a part-time job. She was a supply teacher in nearby Warminster. But there was plenty of money in the bank. She didn't need to work. We talked a lot about Alan as a writer, because that was what I had told her interested me. She had known him at the most interesting time in his career, struggling, getting published for the first time, finding fame. Everyone at Woodbridge School knew that he wanted to be a writer, she told me. He wanted it desperately. That was all he ever talked about. I was actually going out with another of the teachers there, but that ended when Alan came to teach at the school. Are you still in touch with Andreas? She had asked it so casually, and I don't think she noticed when I froze. We had talked long ago at publishing parties, and I had mentioned to her that I knew Andreas, but either I hadn't told her that we were going out together, or she had forgotten it. Andreas, I said. Andreas Patakis. He taught Latin and Greek. He and I had a huge fling. It lasted about a year. We were crazy about each other. You know what these Mediterraneans are like. I'm afraid I treated him badly in the end. But as I say, there was something about Alan that just suited me more. Andreas Patakis. My Andreas. All at once, a whole lot of things fell into place. So this was the reason why Andreas had disliked Alan, and why he resented Alan's success. It was also the reason why, on Sunday evening, he had been so reluctant to tell me what it was about Alan that had annoyed him. How could he admit that he had been going out with Melissa before he met me? What should I think about it? Should I be upset? I had inherited him second-hand. No, that was ridiculous. Andreas had been married twice. There had been plenty of other women in his life. I knew that. But Melissa... I found myself looking at her in a completely different light. She was definitely much less attractive than I had thought. Too thin, boyish even. Better suited to Alan than to Andreas. She hadn't stopped talking. She was still telling me about Alan. I absolutely loved books, and I found him fascinating. I'd never met anyone so driven. He was always talking about stories and ideas, the books he'd read, and the books he wanted to write. He'd done a course at East Anglia University, and he was certain it was going to help him break through. It wasn't enough for him to be published. He wanted to be famous, but it took a lot longer than he'd expected. I was with him throughout the whole process, writing the books, finishing them, and then the horrible disappointment when nobody was interested. You have no idea what it's like, Susan, being rejected. Those letters that turn up in the post with 6 or 7 lines dismissing the work of a whole year. Well, I suppose you're the one who writes them. But to spend all that time writing something, only to find that nobody wants it. It's horribly destructive. They're not just rejecting your work. They're rejecting who you are. And who was Alan? He took writing very seriously. The truth is, he didn't want to write mysteries. The first book he showed me was called Look to the Stars. It was actually very clever and funny, and a little sad. The main character was an astronaut, but he never actually got into space. In a way, I suppose, that was a bit like Alan. Then there was a book set in the south of France. He said it was inspired by Henry James' The Turn of the Screw. It took him 3 years to finish. But again, no one was interested. I couldn't understand it, because I loved his writing, and I completely believed in it. And what makes me angry is that, in the end, I was the one who spoiled it all. I poured myself more sparkling water. I was still thinking about Andreas. "What do you mean?" I asked. "Atticus Punt was my idea." "No, really, it was. You've got to understand that what Alan wanted more than anything was to be published, to be recognized. It killed him to be stuck in a boring independent school in the middle of nowhere, teaching a bunch of kids he didn't even like, and who would forget him the moment they moved on to university. And one day, we'd just been to a bookshop. I suggested that he should write something simpler and more popular. He was always great at puzzles, crosswords and things like that. He had a fascination for tricks and trompe-l'oeil. I told him he should write a whodunit. It seemed to me that there were writers out there who were earning thousands, millions of pounds from books that weren't half as good as his. It would only take him a few months. It might be fun. And if it was a success, he could leave Woodbridge and become a writer full-time, which is what he really wanted. I actually helped him write Atticus Punt Investigates. I was there when he thought up the main character. He told me all his ideas. Where did Atticus come from? They'd just shown Schindler's List on TV, and Alan took him from that. He may have been based on an old English teacher, too. His name was Adrian Pound or something like that. Alan read loads of Agatha Christie books and tried to work out how she wrote her mysteries, and only then did he begin writing. I was the first person to read it. I'm still proud of that. I was the first person in the world to read an Atticus Punt novel. I loved it. Of course, it wasn't as good as his other work. It was lighter and completely pointless, but I thought it was beautifully written, and of course you published it. The rest, you know. You said you spoiled things for him. Everything went wrong after the book came out. You have to understand, Alan was such a complex person. He could be very moody, introvert. For him, writing was something mysterious. It was like he was kneeling at the altar and the words were being sent down to him, or something like that. There were writers that he admired, and more than anything in the world, he had always dreamed of being like them. What writers? Well, Salman Rushdie, for one, Martin Amis, David Mitchell, and Will Self. I remembered the 420 pages of the slide that I had read. I had thought it derivative at the time, but now Melissa had told me where it had come from. Alan had been imitating a writer he admired, but who, personally speaking, I had never been able to read. He had produced something close to a pastiche of Will Self. The moment Atticus Punt came out, he was trapped, Melissa went on. That was what neither of us had anticipated. It was so successful that, of course, nobody wanted him to do anything else. It was better than his other books, I said. Well, you may have thought that, but Alan didn't agree, and nor do I. She sounded bitter. He only wrote Atticus Punt to get out of Woodbridge School, and all it did was put him somewhere worse. But he was rich. He didn't want the money. It was never about money. She sighed. Neither of us had eaten very much lunch. Even if Alan hadn't found this other side of himself, even if he hadn't gone off with James, I don't think we'd have stayed married much longer. He was never the same with me after he got famous. Do you understand what I'm saying, Susan? I'd betrayed him. Worse than that, I persuaded him to betray himself. After another half an hour, maybe 40 minutes, I left. I had to wait for a train at Bradford-on-Avon station, but that suited me. I needed time to think. Andreas and Melissa. Why did it bother me so much? It had been over before the two of us even met. I suppose part of it was natural. A spurt of involuntary jealousy. But at the same time, I was remembering what Andreas had said to me the last time we had spoken.
Is this the best we can do?
I had always assumed that we had both liked the casual nature of our relationship, and I had been annoyed about the hotel because it was changing all that. What Melissa had just told me made me think again. Suddenly I saw how easy it would be to lose him. There was something else that occurred to me. Andreas had lost Melissa to Alan, and he had made it clear that it still rankled. There was certainly no love lost between them. And this time, all these years later, Alan was the main reason why he might lose me. I was his editor. My career was largely predicated on the success of his books. I've hated the way you've had to kowtow to him. That was what he had said. I suddenly saw that Andreas, as much as anyone, must have been very glad to see him dead. I needed to distract myself, so as soon as I was on the train, I took out Magpie Murders. But this time, instead of reading it, I tried to decipher it. I couldn't get away from the idea that Alan Conway had concealed something inside the text, and that it might even be the reason he was killed. I remembered the crossword that Clarissa Pye had solved, and the code games the two boys had played at the lodge. When Alan was at Chorley Hall, he had sent his sister acronyms, and he'd put dots under certain letters in books to send secret messages. There were no dots in the typescript of Magpie Murders. I had already checked. But his books had contained British rivers, tube stations, fountain pens, birds. This was a man who played electronic Scrabble in his spare time. He was always great at puzzles, crosswords, and things like that. That was the very reason why Melissa had persuaded him to try his hand at murder mystery in the first place. I was sure that if I looked hard enough, there would be something I would find. I figured I knew where the characters had originated, so I ignored them. If I was looking for secret messages, acronyms seemed the more likely possibility. The first letters of the first word of each chapter, for example, spelled out T-T-A-A-D-A. Nothing there. Then I tried the first 10 sentences, which began T-T-T-B-H-T-I. And the first letters of the first word of each section, T-S-D-W. I didn't need to continue. That didn't mean anything either. I looked at the title of the book. Magpie Murders could be rearranged to make Reared Pig Mums. Reread Smug Imp. Premium Grades, and many more. It was a puerile activity. I wasn't expecting to find anything, not really. But it occupied my mind as we trundled back to London. I didn't want to think about what Melissa had told me. And then, somewhere between Swindon and Didcot, I saw it. It just assembled itself in front of my eyes. The titles of the books. The clues had always been there. James had told me that the number of books was important. Alan always said that there would be 9 books. He decided that from the very start. Why 9? Because that was his secret message. That was what he wanted to spell out. Look at the first letters. Atticus Punt investigates. No rest for the wicked. Atticus Punt takes the case. Night comes calling. Atticus Punt's Christmas. Gin and cyanide. Red roses for Atticus. Atticus Punt abroad. If you add the last title, Magpie Murders, what do you get? An anagram. And finally, that explained something that had been on my mind for a while. The Ivy Club. Alan had got angry when Charles had suggested changing the title of the last book. What was it that he said? I'm not having the... That was the moment when Donald Lee dropped the plates. But in fact, there was no missing word. He had actually completed the sentence. What he was saying was the book could not be called The Magpie Murders, because that would spoil the joke that Alan had built into the series almost from the day it was conceived. He'd come up with an anagram. But an anagram of what? An hour later, the train pulled into Paddington, and I still hadn't seen it. Paddington Station. I don't like coincidences in novels, and particularly not in murder mysteries, which work because of logic and calculation. The detective really should be able to reach his conclusion without having Providence on his side. But that's just the editor in me speaking, and unfortunately, this is what happened. Getting off the train at 5:02, in a city of 8.5 million people, with thousands of them crossing the concourse all around me, I bumped into someone I knew. Her name was Jemima Humphreys. Until very recently, she had been Charles Clover's PA at Cloverleaf. I saw her and recognized her at once. Charles always said that she had the sort of smile that could light up a crowd, and that was what first caught my eye, the fact that she alone looked cheerful among the grey mass of commuters making their way home. She was slim and pretty, with long blonde hair, and although she was in her mid-twenties, she had lost none of her schoolgirl exuberance. I remember her telling me that she had wanted to get into publishing because she loved reading. I'd already missed having her around the office. I had no idea why she'd left. She saw me at the same moment and waved. We made our way towards each other, and I thought we were just going to say hello, and I was going to ask her how she was. But that wasn't what happened. "How are you, Jemima?" I asked.
"I'm fine, thanks, Susan. It's really great to see you. I'm sorry I didn't get to say goodbye."
"It all happened so quickly. I was away on a book tour, and when I got back, you'd already gone."
"I know.
So, where are you now?"
"I'm living with my parents in Chiswick. I was just on my way..."
"Where are you working?"
"I haven't got a job yet."
She giggled nervously.
"I'm still looking."
That puzzled me. I'd assumed she'd been poached.
"So why did you leave?" I asked. "I didn't leave, Susan. Charles fired me. Well, he asked me to go. I didn't want to."
That wasn't what Charles had told me. I was sure he'd said she'd handed in her notice.
It was already 5:30, and I wanted to go to the office and go through my emails before I met Andreas. But something told me I couldn't leave it like this. I had to know more.
"Are you in a hurry?" I asked.
"No, not really. Can I buy you a drink?"
We made our way to one of those grimy, frankly hellish pubs that edge onto the platforms at Paddington Station. I bought myself a gin and tonic, which arrived with not enough ice. Jemima had a glass of white wine.
"So, what happened?" I asked.
Jemima frowned.
"I'm not sure, to be honest with you, Susan. I really liked working at Cloverleaf, and Charles was fine most of the time. He could be quite snappy now and then, but I didn't mind, because in a way that was part of the job. Anyway, we had a big row. It must have been the day you went off on that book tour. He said I'd double-booked him for a lunch, and there was an agent sitting in a restaurant waiting for him. But it simply wasn't true. I never made any mistakes with his diary. But when I tried to argue with him, he got really angry. I'd never seen him like that before. He was completely over the top. And then, on the Friday morning, I took him a coffee in his office, and as I handed it to him, he sort of fumbled it, and it went all over his desk. It was a terrible mess, and I went out and got kitchen towel and cleared it up for him. And that was when he said he didn't think it was working, him and me, and that I should start looking for another job."
"He fired you on the spot?"
"Not exactly. I was very upset. I mean, the thing with the coffee, it really wasn't me. I was going to put it on his desk like I always did, but he reached out to take it and knocked it out of my hand. And it wasn't as if I'd made loads of mistakes. I'd been with him for a year, and everything had gone all right. We had a long talk, and I think it was me who said to him that it would be better if I went straight away. And he said he'd pay me a month's salary, so that was it. He also said he'd give me a good reference, and that if anyone asked, I hadn't been fired, I just decided to leave."
Charles had stuck with that. That was what he told me.
"I suppose that was nice of him," she went on. "I just left at the end of the day, and that was that."
"What day was that?" I asked.
"It was Friday morning. You were on your way back from Dublin."
She remembered something.
"Did Andreas ever catch up with you?"
she asked.
"I'm sorry?"
I could feel my head spinning. It was the second time that Andreas had been mentioned today. Melissa had suddenly dragged him into the conversation,
and now Jemima had done the same. She knew him, of course. She'd met him a few times and taken messages from him. But why was she mentioning him now? "He came in the day before," Jemima continued cheerfully. "He wanted to see you after his meeting with Charles."
"I'm sorry, Jemima. I tried to take this slowly. You must be making a mistake. Andreas wasn't in England that week. He was in Crete.
He did look very tanned. But I'm not making a mistake. It was a horrible week for me, and I sort of remember everything that happened. He came in on Thursday at about 3 o'clock.
And he saw Charles.
That's right. She looked perplexed. I hope I haven't done something wrong. He didn't say not to tell you.
But he hadn't told me himself. Quite the opposite. We'd had our big reunion dinner. He had said he was in Crete. I wanted to leave Andreas out of this. I went back to Charles. "There's no way he'd want to lose you," I said. I wasn't really talking to her. I was talking to myself, trying to work it out. And it was true. I could easily see Charles losing his temper in the way she'd described. But not with her. Jemima had been his third secretary in as many years, and I know he liked her. There had been Olivia, who got on his nerves, and Cat, who was always late. Third time lucky, that's what he'd said. Jemima was efficient and hard-working. She made him laugh. How could he have changed his mind so suddenly?
"I don't know," she said. "He'd had a bad couple of weeks. When all the reviews came out for that book, The One-Armed Juggler, he was really upset, and I know he wasn't too happy about Magpie Murders either. He was worried about his daughter. Honestly, Susan, I was doing everything I could to help, but he just needed someone to shout at, and I was the one who happened to be in the room. Did Laura have her baby?"
"Yes," I said, although actually I didn't know. "I haven't heard if it's a boy or a girl."
"Well, send good wishes from me." We talked a little more. Jemima was working part-time, helping her mother, who was a solicitor. She was thinking about spending the winter in Verbier. She was a keen snowboarder and thought she could get work as a chalet girl. But I didn't really listen to what she was saying. I wanted to telephone Andreas. I wanted to know why he had lied to me. It was just as we were separating that another thought struck me. I was replaying something she had said to me.
"You mentioned that Charles wasn't happy with Magpie Murders," I said. "What was the problem?"
"I don't know, he didn't say. But he was definitely upset about something. I thought maybe it wasn't any good."
"But he hadn't read it yet."
"Hadn't he?" She sounded surprised. She was anxious to be on her way, but I stopped her. None of this was making any sense. Alan had delivered the new book after Jemima had left. He had given it to Charles at the Ivy Club on Thursday, the 27th of August, the same day, it now turned out, Andreas had visited him at Cloverleaf Books. I had got back on the 28th and had found a copy of the manuscript waiting for me. We had both read it over the weekend, the same weekend Alan died. So what could Charles have been unhappy about? "Charles was only given the book after you'd left," I said.
"No, that's not true. It came in the post."
"When?"
"On Tuesday."
"How do you know?"
"I opened it."
I stared at her.
"Did you see the title?"
"Yes, it was on the front page."
"Was the book complete?"
That confused her. "I don't know, Susan. I just gave it to Charles. He was very pleased to have it, but he didn't say anything afterwards. And anyway, a few days later, the coffee thing happened, and that was that." There were people swirling past. A voice boomed out over the tannoys, announcing the departure of a train. I thanked Jemima, gave her a brief hug, and hurried to find a taxi.
Cloverleaf Books. I didn't call Andreas. I wanted to, but there was something else I had to do first. The offices were closed by the time I got there, but I had a key and let myself in, deactivated the alarms, and climbed the stairs up to the first floor. I turned on the lights,
But without anyone in there, the building still felt dark and oppressive, the shadows refusing to budge. I knew exactly where I was going. Charles's office was never locked, and I went straight in. There were two armchairs in empty conference, with Charles's desk in front of me. The shelves with all his books, his awards, his photographs were on one side. Bella's basket was on the other, tucked next to a cabinet that contained bottles and glasses. How many times had I sat here, late into the evening, sipping Glenmorangie malt whiskey, talking over the problems of the day? I was here now as an intruder, and I had a sense that I was smashing everything that I had helped build up over the past 11 years. I walked over to the desk. I was in such a mood that if the drawers had been locked, I wouldn't have hesitated to break them open, antique or not. But Charles hadn't taken even this measure of security. The drawers slid open eagerly in my hands to reveal contracts, cost reports, invoices, proofs, newspaper clippings, unwanted wires from old computers and mobile phones, photographs. And at the very bottom, clumsily concealed, a plastic folder containing about 20 sheets of paper. The first page was almost blank, with a heading in capitals. 7. A secret never to be told. The missing chapters. They had been here all the time. And in the end, the title had been absolutely true. The solution to the murder of Sir Magnus Pye had to be kept a secret because of the way it related to the murder of Alan Conway. I thought I heard something. Had there been a creak on the stairs outside? I turned the page and began to read. Atticus Punt took one last walk around Saxby-on-Avon while James Fraser paid the bill at the Queen's Head. He had arranged to meet Detective Inspector Chubb and two others at the Bath police station in an hour's time. He had not been here long, but in a strange way, he had come to know the village quite intimately. The church, the castle, the antique shop in the square, the bus shelter, the Queen's Head and the ferryman. He could no longer see them separately. They had become the chessboard on which this particular game, surely his last, had been played. It was his last game, because he was dying. Atticus Punt and Alan Conway were going out together. That was what this was all about. The writer and a character he hated, both heading towards their Reichenbach Falls. It had all come to me at Paddington Station, the extraordinary moment that all of them must have felt, Poirot, Holmes, Whimsy, Marple, Morse, but which their authors had never fully explained. What was it like for them? A slow process, like constructing a jigsaw? Or did it come in a rush? One last turn in a toy kaleidoscope when all the colours and shapes tumbled and twisted into each other, forming a recognisable image. That was what had happened to me. The truth had been there, but it had taken a final nudge for me to see it. All of it. Would it have happened if I hadn't met Jemima Humphreys? I'll never know for sure, but I think I would have got there in the end. There were little bits of information, red herrings that I'd had to get out of my head. For example, the television producer, Mark Redmond, hadn't told me that he'd stayed at the Crown Hotel in Framlingham over the weekend. Why not? The answer was quite simple when I thought about it. When he talked to me, he deliberately made it seem that he was on his own. It was only the receptionist at the hotel who'd mentioned that he was with his wife. But suppose it wasn't his wife. Suppose it was a secretary or a starlet. That would have been good reason for a longer stay, and a good reason to lie about it. And then there was James Taylor. He really had been in London with friends. The photograph of John White and Alan on the tower. White had gone round to see Alan on that Sunday morning. No wonder he and his housekeeper had looked uncomfortable when I spoke to them. The two of them had argued about the lost investment. But it wasn't White who had attempted to kill Alan. It was the other way round. Wasn't that obvious? Alan had grabbed hold of him at the top of the tower, and the two of them had grappled for a moment. That was what the photograph showed. It was actually Alan's killer who had taken it. I flicked through a few more pages. I'm not sure I particularly cared who had killed Sir Magnus Pye, not at the moment anyway. But I knew what I was looking for, and sure enough,
There it was, in part two of the final chapter. It took him a short time to write